The Bob Murphy Show, episode 43.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of The Bob Murphy Show. We're continuing with this episode in my new theme of healthcare economics. And so what you're going to hear is the first part of a long conversation that I had with medical doctor Michelle Akkad. And I interacted with him following my presentation at the Free Market Medical Association meetings. I think this was back in April. This is 2019. And so longtime listeners, you'll know that I presented there. And then we had Dr. Keith Smith of the Surgery Center of Oklahoma on here, the Bob Murphy Show, and I'll link to his episode as well. And so, as I mentioned to you, I'm going to be trying to interview various people associated with the Free Market Medical Association. So that's what we were going to do here. But then Michelle said, you know, why don't we talk about Kenneth Arrow's famous paper on healthcare economics, and the one that guys like Krugman nowadays would point to as the pioneering article that showed why the healthcare and health insurance sectors are plagued by so-called market failures. But that what Michelle wanted to do is he said, why don't we first just take time and go through what modern economists mean by market failure and what's their notion of efficiency, things like that. So it turned out where we had two almost entirely self-contained conversations. And even as we were recording it, we took a break in between and so on. So that's why I'm splitting it up into two separate episodes. So what you're hearing today in episode 43 of the Bob Murphy Show is our discussion. It's largely just me talking about the history of economic thought. And, you know, Michelle's guiding me through the topic with an aim to getting the building blocks in place so that then in our follow-up discussion, which you folks are going to hear as episode 45 of the Bob Murphy Show, so there's going to be a lag. I'm splitting it up over, I'm putting something else in between so as not to overwhelm you. That's going to be Michelle and me just going through Arrow's paper and relying on the legwork that we have done in the prior conversation, again, which you're about to hear now in episode 43. Okay, so that's the game plan. Again, to summarize, I am being interviewed here by Dr. Michelle Akkad, and he is going to first take me through and have me explain the development of modern economic theory, at least as practiced by mainstream economists, and in particular, the notion of efficiency and market failure that they use when they want to say things like, oh, the free market doesn't work in healthcare because of such and such. I'll explain what the theoretical framework is for those types of statements. And then in our follow-up conversation, which you're going to hear as episode 45, he and I will then go through Kenneth Arrow's famous paper that many point to as the foundation of modern healthcare economics. So without further ado, here is my first conversation with Dr. Michelle Akkad. Hope you like it.
Bob Murphy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Michelle.
It's great to have you. What a great opportunity for me to have a real economist, not only a real economist, but a real economist in the sense that an economist who believes in real causes and effects. And maybe we'll get into what that means later on as we have our conversation here. But to have you illustrate, you know, for myself and for the audience, the meaning and the background for this very important paper. I think many of us know that this paper by Kenneth Arrow is important. But for lay people, it's not an easy paper to read or to breeze through or to understand exactly what he's talking about, even though some passages are written in plain English and many paragraphs are actually, we can understand what he's saying. But the overall gist of the article is a little bit difficult to grasp.
I noticed that too as I was rereading it for, you know, in preparation for this discussion, that is if you're a trained economist, you know exactly what he's saying. But yeah, if you don't know, he'd be pretty mysterious at points.
Correct. So I think, you know, we've agreed to do this maybe in two parts. And at first, to actually just, if you could give us the background to this paper, I mean, the theoretical background to this paper, to what is called welfare economics. Again, the title of the paper is Uncertainty and the Welfare Economics of Medical Care. So welfare economics is actually a subdiscipline in economic theory. And it's part, I guess, of what is called neoclassical economics. Is that correct?
Yeah. So yeah, just to, I'll give a little bit, then obviously, Michelle, just you jump in and redirect me if you think I'm missing something or your listeners will be confused.
Okay.
So right. So the first thing I should clarify is, in terms of economic theory or branches of economics, when we talk about welfare economics, that doesn't refer to welfare payments from the government.
That's right.
So it's not talking about. So people shouldn't be confused. It means instead just the term like human well-being, you know, like, oh, we want to promote the general welfare. Like that's the sense in which the term is used. And so another important distinction is that when it comes to economics, you have what's called positive economics versus normative economics. So positive theory is just saying these are just factual statements about how an economy works. Just like a physicist could, you know, have F equals MA or E equals MC squared. And, you know, there's no moral judgment or any preference being exhibited by the scientist in making those statements. And so likewise with economics, that's what a positive statement would be. When it comes to normative economics, though, it's where the analyst tries to evaluate different outcomes or different social institutions, perhaps, to say, you know, can we say that one's better than the other?
Okay, to make some recommendations for policy.
Right, right. And so here this is the tradition. That's what welfare economics is. It's saying, what can we say about, you know, as economists having to do with the promotion of human welfare? And so the point is, they want to be really careful about, or at least this is what they think they're doing. And I think as the discussion goes on, we'll get into whether in practice they actually do this. There's different standards or benchmarks by which you could evaluate an outcome to say, is this good or bad? And so this also is where the word optimal comes into play.
Okay.
So that's maybe another way of distinguishing it, that in terms of just positive economic analysis, you could talk about equilibrium, which means just, you know, the system is stable, you know, it's at rest. There's no reason for it to deviate from that particular state. So it's in equilibrium, but the equilibrium could be bad in some sense, or it might not be optimal. And so the optimality comes in. The two main benchmarks are what's called Pareto optimality or efficiency. That's another word that's often
right.
used as efficiency.
And these are terms that Arrow brings up in his paper early on, but mm-hmm. I was wondering if we can take even a step further back.
Sure.
And because even the concept of equilibrium mm-hmm. is relatively recent. I mean, relatively recent, maybe 100 years ago or so, 120, 130 years ago. And so I was wondering if you can tell us a little bit. So modern economics, again, I'm going to, the term is not used here, but neoclassical economics is a term that is employed to refer to this kind of economic theory that Arrow exemplifies. And that's in opposition to what might be called classical economics. Is that correct?
Let me tell me
a little bit what the distinction is. Why do we talk about neoclassical economics?
Sure.
Because it's in neoclassical economics that the concepts of equilibrium and optimality and all that stuff comes about.
Okay, sure. So the classical economists are people like Adam Smith, David Ricardo, John Stuart Mill, Frederick Bastiat. And so there's different ways of describing those people. They all do tend to be pretty free market or laissez-faire. But, and by the way, that phrase laissez-faire is obviously French. And so mm-hmm. showing that the great French classical economists like Bastiat and J.B. Say, you know, were big proponents of what we would call the free market economy. But in terms of like economic theory and why, what is it about the classical school and where do we draw the boundary line? Like who comes after the classicals? The important revolution came in the early 1870s. So Karl Menger in 1871, William Stanley Jevons and Leon Walras, all like 1871, and I think one of them was in 1874, two of them were 1871. They all sort of independently came up with what we now call subjective value theory. So that's really the
Okay.
The distinction. So the old classical economists, believe it or not, they actually, like guys like Adam Smith and even Frederick Bastiat, when you ask them, you know, how do we explain market prices? Like, why is it that a stagecoach trades for so many, whatever, ounces of silver and a bushel of apples trades for a different number? And, you know, how do you explain the, like, how many apples one stagecoach trades for in the marketplace? The way they would explain that would be either a cost or a labor theory of value, even though we tend to think of Karl Marx. He didn't invent that stuff. Actually, Karl Marx would be a classical economist because he had a labor theory of value, but so did Adam Smith.
Right. And I think that's an important topic to bring up. You know, the labor theory of value seems intuitive for a lot of us, right? A lot of lay people. We think, oh, something costs more because you put more time or more resources or... You know, you spent 4 years in medical school and 4 years of residency and da da da. Therefore, as a doctor, you ought to make, a six-figure salary or whatnot.
Yeah. Or some, you know, lovely blanket is very expensive. And someone says, why does it cost so much? Oh, because it's hand stitched.
Right.
So it has to cost that much because of all the labor that goes into it, you know, those kinds of statements. So, in one sense, I mean, it wasn't a bad starting point. You're right. It's pretty natural they would say that. So it's true. If you just look around, you take a snapshot of the market prices that exist on a given day of the week, and you look around, you'll tend to be true that the things that cost more, you know, they have a higher price, I should say, also have higher costs of production. And then, you know, you could push back and say, well, why do they cost so much? And I think where the labor theory of value people were coming from is to say, ultimately, nature doesn't charge us for, you know, her inputs. It's just, you know, the one major constraint in every operation is you got to get some human to voluntarily toil for it, and that's unpleasant. And so that's really what you're paying for. That's like the choke point, the limit on the stuff that we can produce as humans with the resources we have. So that, and by the way, there are problems with that formulation, but that I think that's where they were coming from intuitively. And so certainly, yeah, if a stagecoach takes 1,000 hours to produce and a bushel of apples only takes a few hours to gather, it makes sense. Oh, yeah, that's the reason the stagecoach costs so much more, has a higher price, because there's more labor hours that went into it. So with the subjective value theorists it was called the marginal revolution, this episode in economic history or the development of economic thought, what their insight was is to say, no, ultimately the fundamental building block to explain market prices is subjective valuation. And there's real easy ways to illustrate the distinction here. So there's some like Van Gogh painting. And to explain its price, obviously we don't need to know how many hours did Van Gogh labor on that. The point is just, what are people willing to pay for it? It depends on how much mm-hmm. pleasure does it give you. So the things like that are non-reproducible, clearly a labor theory or a cost theory of value has nothing to do with it. If you were just walking out in the woods and you found some abandoned car and you wanted to use it, and then you took it to the marketplace and wanted to sell it, obviously, nobody would say, well, we have no idea what its price should be because we need to figure out, you know, who built this thing and how much labor power went into it. Clearly, that's just a fact of history. You don't need to know, especially like if you found some kind of alien technology that we had no idea. Clearly, if we could figure out how to use it, it would have a price, you know, if it could make food or energy or something without us even knowing where it came from. So clearly, you know, there's cases where, so in other words, market prices, it can't be the full story to explain them by reference to how many labor hours went into them, because of those examples I just gave you. And then going the other way, if somebody spends thousands of hours, you know, making a mud pie or something, or a car that has broken glass all along the seat, nobody's going to buy that thing. They're not going to pay anything for it. And so clearly the connection between how much labor power you put into something and its price is very tenuous at best. And so the more modern formulation says, yes, what those classical economists pointed at with certain regularities that ex post, you know, in there's competitive forces that makes there tend to be a pattern where price corresponds to the cost of the inputs that went into it. But it's not that one causes the other. It's more of a correlation, not causation. And that's why, too, like if all of a sudden it starts raining and vendors are selling umbrellas on the street, like in New York City, it starts pouring and the people who have, you know, umbrellas for sale, the price of the umbrellas might jump up a few dollars.
Right.
And that's obviously because what we now say supply and demand or scarcity. It's not because all of a sudden they realized, oh, wait, it took more hours to make these umbrellas than we realized. Clearly, that's not what's going on. So that was the revolution in economic thought.
Okay. And it's So that happens in the 1870s, and and nobody disputes this point of view anymore, right? I mean, for the most part, except perhaps Marxists or...
Yeah, right. So there was a guy, his name was Kevin Carson. He tried to do a rehabilitation of a labor theory of value, and we had a symposium in the Journal of Libertarian Studies, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, where we critiqued it. So I don't think he succeeded. So yes, it is generally accepted. There are some throwbacks. I think modern Marxists, you know, they're aware of the developments, and they try to resurrect the theory and to bring in subjective elements into it. But yeah, I think that they still would ultimately cling to a labor theory of value that they try to patch up in light of, you know, what other people have said since the 1800s.
So how do we go from the marginal revolution and the subjective value theory to the concepts of equilibrium and optimality? And this refers to the allocation of resources in the economy and that sort of thing.
You had maybe the next little thing to plug is this issue of the term neoclassical.
Okay.
So obviously neo meaning new. I think the way I think it's normally taught in a history of economic thought is that Alfred Marshall, so you had the classical economists and they had lots of great insights, in particular the case for free trade. You know, so right. There's a lot of, and you know, and Adam Smith's Invisible Hand. So all these things that we associate with people like Adam Smith, David Ricardo, great economists, ironically, they made all those contributions, even with what we now view as, an unsatisfactory theory of market price formation or of value.
Right.
So then after the 1870s, of course, there's this whole revolution, and someone like Alfred Marshall comes along, and he had, you know, at the time, the biggest, so this is like the turn of the century, has the biggest textbook, you know, the most influential, sort of setting the standard for, you know, this is the state of the art when it comes to economics. And he very consciously tried to retain all of the insights from the old classical school, but then to supplement them with this new, clearly superior way of explaining value and price. And so that's, I don't know, I can't remember off the top of my head if Marshall himself used the term neoclassical or other people just came up with it.
Okay.
But that's the idea. So the point was, we're not throwing out the classical tradition, but we are realizing there's some, you know, augmentations it needs. So that's
sure.
So that's neoclassical. In our modern time, neoclassical, when someone says, oh yeah, that's a neoclassical model, what they mean is it's a mathematical, you know, system of equations describing a model of an economy. But they generally assume that there's competitive markets, that individuals maximize utility, there's equilibrium. That's kind of, you know,
right.
So it's like sort of like the old classical approach, but augmented with more, you know, mathematical tools in this modern theory of value.
So how did the mathematics get into the picture? Because if you read Adam Smith, it's all, you know, plain language, mm-hmm. and same thing with Ricardo and whatnot. And then you have the marginal revolution. And that, maybe the term marginal itself is indicative of some quantification or some appeal to quantification and to use of math. And I say that because this paper by Arrows, if you look at the appendix, it's four pages of just equations after
right.
equations after equations. Mm-hmm. And so how did that get into, you know, instead of describing what people do with plain language, you know, how did,
right.
you know, economists
yeah, great
start question. To,
yeah.
yeah.
So why don't... So that first of all, that phrase marginal revolution, let me explain where that term comes from. So it has to do with, and we even have this now in like a principles class, you'd say like, oh, how do you think like an economist? And there's some principles like there's always opportunity cost or every choice has a cost, things like that. One of the principles of how to think like an economist might be to say people make decisions on the margin, or you should
right.
analyze situations on the margin. So what that means is like, think of like a book page, the margin is the edge, right? So it's saying it's the edge cases. And so one of the ways that the new so-called marginal revolution changed the analysis of market prices is that they were realizing when you're looking and saying, you know, why is it that, I'll use the standard example here is water and diamonds. It was called mm-hmm. the water diamond mm-hmm. paradox. So the old classical school, They knew that human satisfaction or needs or desires had something to do with prices, obviously. Like, they weren't stupid. They understood people pay for stuff that they want and that makes them happy or better off in some sense. But it was kind of a puzzle you know, you would think then that water should have a much higher price than diamonds, because water is essential to life, whereas diamonds are just a luxury item. So, you know, you would think if market price has something to do with human well-being, you know, the essentials should have a higher price. So the resolution of that is that you're not at any moment, in any given market transaction, you're not buying or choosing all the water you'll ever need versus all the diamonds you might ever need. It's particular units. You're making a decision on the margin. And so the question is, do you want one more gallon of water or one more, you know, bag of diamonds? Clearly you'll pick the diamonds, because again, there you're just talking about on the margin, one more or one less. And right. That's the way to think about it.
Unless you're in the middle of the desert.
Right.
And you only have a quart of water, and you may buy, you know, pay more for the additional quart than for a diamond.
Yeah, exactly. And that exactly illustrates the principle, right? So that's, right. Yes, if you're in the middle of just dying of thirst and you have a diamond ring and you see someone walking along with 6 gallons of water, he might say, I'll give you this water for your ring. And yeah, you might do it in that situation. Again, because in that situation, you have so little water at your disposal that on the margin, getting a few more gallons really makes a difference to you. Whereas in a normal situation, you've got plenty of water relative to your uses for water. So that's the way that Menger and Jevons and Walras explained things. And it was like, oh, wow, that's, you know, in other words, the classical economists weren't thinking like that in terms of marginal units. And so they really had no hope of solving it. Once you use that approach, it's real simple. And the example I like to give, if I'm, you know, teaching this to a lay audience, the principle is, if you're just trying to explain something simple, like why is it that bottles of water or cans of Coke in the grocery store, like, you know, that's it's a special sale. It's $5 for a 6-pack or something, and or 2-liter, whatever. And you're trying to explain things. It's let me make the numbers. Say it's $1 just for a bottle of water, just to keep things simple.
Okay.
And you start, and when you're trying to explain it, if you were saying, which might be reasonable, like, oh, is $1 for a bottle of water a fair price or not, or a good price or a good bargain? If that's the way you're analyzing it, then that means people leaving the store should either have no bottles of water in their cart, or they should have mortgaged their house and walked out with as many bottles of water as the store had. Right. Because, oh, if it's a good price,
right,
if, you know, if the bottle of water is worth more than $1 and they're charging $1, why wouldn't I get as many as possible?
Right.
And obviously in the real world, that's not what people do. They put some in their cart, possibly zero, but at some point they stop. And I know this is a really obvious point, but that's the way you have to think of it. So what's going, if you start out with like $10 and zero bottles and you put the first bottle in your cart, that's because, oh, you valued the first bottle of water more than the 10th dollar bill. You put a second one in, you value the second bottle more than the 9th dollar bill. But at some point you stop because maybe, you know, whatever, the 6th bottle is not worth the 5th dollar bill or whatever, how the math right. works out. And then to even just talk like that, you realize it's not that water has a certain utility to you. It's that you got to do it unit by unit. You got to think on the margin.
I think that's a great example.
Yeah. So right, it's real. It obviously is real, you know, kindergartner stuff here. But my point is, unless you think of it in that way, you can't explain market prices. You got to start on the right foundation. Otherwise, you end up, you know,
it's funny because in common discourse or commentary or on social media and whatnot, people talk about prices in the absolute.
Right.
Right. I mean, the price of something should be X, or that's a good price, or that's, you know, without thinking the way you've described it.
Or they'll say, it's crazy that, In our society, a baseball pitcher gets paid, you know, 600 times more than an elementary school teacher.
Right.
Like, don't we value education more than, you know, people throwing baseballs around? And again, the answer is, no, you got to think on the margin. Yeah, it's true. If society were choosing between education and baseball as whole classes, they would probably pick education. Maybe not. Maybe some people would say, not baseball. But that's not the choice. The choice is between, you know, would you want to get the services of this one particular guy who can throw 100-mile-per-hour fastball versus a teacher who, you know, and so the solution, of course, is the scarcity. There are not many people have the ability, even with training, to be a major league pitcher, whereas lots of people, if they went through sufficient training, could, you know, teach third grade arithmetic or something.
Right, right. Okay. So then how does that get us to the mathematics?
Oh, okay. So you're right. If you go read the classical economists, they're it's verbal expositions. David Ricardo is one where a lot of historians of economic thought will say that Ricardo had a mathematical model, but he just expounded it in words. So in other words, Ricardo was thinking about explaining economics in terms of a model and, you know, here's different sectors and here's what the equilibrium condition would be, even though he was spelling it out verbally.
Okay.
But his exposition was very, you know, was anticipating the way economics would develop. The one who really was the path-breaking person in mathematical models would be Leon Walras. So he's one of the ones associated with the marginal revolution. So his exposition was putting, you know, differential equations. And then, and so Alfred Marshall, I believe, had an appendix with a lot of the math. And I hope I'm not getting the quote wrong. I believe it was Marshall who said something like, or maybe it was Fisher, now I'm getting mixed up, but one of those giants at the, you know, turn of the century said, yeah, you do the, you could do the math in the appendix or whatever, but then burn the appendix or something like that. Like trying to say, if you can't translate it from the math back to plain language, it's not good economics. You know, there's a problem there. If you can really only express it in math, you should always be able to translate. But as time went on, it became more rigorous. I think so Paul Samuelson was a huge person in this field who he won the Nobel Prize in economics and was one who really mathematized it. And so he was, you know, a whiz kid mathematically. And I think part of it was the economists suffered from physics envy. And so they wanted to show people, like, look how rigorous our discipline is. And so the benefit of doing stuff in terms of math is it's very precise. And so there's no misunderstanding about what your claim is. Like, you can make an argument in words and maybe there's a fallacy that slips in. And so you end up convincing people of the conclusion, even though they're in, you know, the chain of your logic, there was a mistake from step 4 to 5 that you kind of slid through rhetorically. Whereas if you do something mathematically, strictly speaking, modern economics papers and journal articles, they're mathematical proofs. And, you know, the actual meat of the paper, it's a proof. There's theorems and stuff. And so, you know, it's a lot easier to check someone's work and to make sure that the theorem is valid. And so I know we'll probably go on, but that's where it came from. And so I think, you know, so the idea was the economists thought, oh, this is more rigorous. We're not arguing over words. This is, you know, we can know exactly what the claim is and we can tell whether it's true or false.
Well, that's interesting because what they mathematized, at least, correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, perhaps one of the first thing that emerges is what's called a utility function.
Mm-hmm.
Something that, I mean, because as you've illustrated that our wants, our desire for a certain good will tend to diminish the more we accumulate, right? The more units we accumulate.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can imagine sort of a mathematical or at least some kind of quantitative relationship between the amounts of goods that you have and how much you subjectively are going to value them. Right, that sort of thing. And is that how sort of the mathematics start to model? They start to model a little bit this relationship between the consumer and their how they value goods and the quantity of goods available.
Okay, sure. So, right. So remember back to that example about, you know, buying bottles of water in the store. And we were saying that the way you can make sense of real people's behavior is that the more money you spend on one particular type of good, you know, you're ending up with fewer and fewer dollar bills left in your possession and you're getting more and more units of that good. And so this principle of what's called diminishing marginal utility, that it would explain why you would eventually stop. Because as you're getting more and more units of the water, each successive unit is less important to you than the previous one.
Right.
And with the money, as you're spending more and more money, that means each prior unit now is more important to you than the last one you just gave up. And so at some point, that last, you know, marginal dollar you have is more important to you. You have a better use for it than to spend it acquiring, you know, another unit of the water. So you can see how that notion or that concept of diminishing marginal utility helps, you know, coupled with the framework of subjective value theory, helps to explain consumer behavior.
Right.
And then ultimately you can use that to build a downward sloping demand curve, right? So I'm sure some of them are having horrible flashbacks to college classes, but the idea of a demand curve, meaning you put price on the y-axis and quantity on the x-axis. And so a downward sloping curve means as the price goes down, the quantity you want to buy goes up, or the quantity that the market wants to buy goes up.
Okay.
And so if you think about it, that's you can see how if you made certain assumptions that every consumer has diminishing marginal utility, that kind of goes hand in hand with building a downward sloping demand curve. And that's kind of the way you make sense of normal market operations. I'm obviously glossing over some technicalities, but that's the intuition.
Right. And we don't want to get into too many ideas, but at least to get a sense to, you know, since Arrow talks about equilibrium and optimality and whatnot, I just get a sense of how these things came about.
Sure.
And
so that's the idea. So in terms of consumers, you can see how, oh yeah, other things equal, you get more and more units of something, you dedicate it to a less and less important thing. And that's just, you know, that's not an empirical observation. That's just like logical that, oh yeah, the first unit of something you would dedicate to what you think is the most important use. And by the way, these are all subjective things, right? So, there's nothing saying what those uses are, and they could differ from person to person. Like somebody might really think washing his car is very important, whereas somebody else wants to give water to his dog. Right. And so those people might, you know, the way they order and how much is the fifth gallon of water, you know, how important is it to me, you know, that might differ from
sure.
In one sense too, you can't even compare, but you're asking about mathematically. So you can see how, yes, there's a quantitative system going on. So somebody like Carl Menger was not as quantitative about it. They mostly tried to explain it in words, but even with him and even with Bombavrik and the early Austrians, they did, at least in their exposition, to get the reader to see what they meant. They would assign numbers to these things. And so, you know, Bombavrik, I'm making these numbers up, but he might say like, oh yeah, that first gallon of water, you know, gives you 100 units of utility, and the second one might only give you 90 units of utility, like that, just to try to explain.
Right.
So there was this cardinal notion, at least. Later on, economists, it was actually with Pareto, realize we can get rid of that stuff. That, you know, we don't need to assume that utility is like this psychic measurable substance. We can just look at bundles of goods and rank them in a, you know, an ordinal fashion, if people know the difference between cardinal and ordinal. But to answer your question, yeah, ultimately, to build a model to make sense of consumer behavior, economists realize, and this is where like Paul Samuelson was one of the pathbreakers, was just realizing, oh, if we make certain assumptions about how people prefer, or, you know, given different collections of goods, which ones they would prefer, you can describe that consumer behavior by this thing called a utility function. And so what it's a function, so it takes inputs and then points to a number. You know, that's what a function does.
Right.
And what it's doing is just saying, yeah, you plug in how many units of the different goods that are available in this little model economy to this individual in the world of the economy who's, you know, an acting agent. And a number shoots out from the utility function. And so we assume that what the agent tries to do mathematically is he has a budget, he sees the prices, and he maximizes his utility subject to the constraint that he can't spend more than his budget. So it just turns into a constrained optimization problem. So it's, you know, our mathematicians have known different techniques for solving that. So that's what I mean. If you go to grad school now, you're mostly learning a bunch of math because you have to learn how do you solve constrained optimization problems mathematically, because that's what economics is.
Right.
And likewise, the firm maximizes profit, you know, so its output times the market price of the good it's selling is its revenue minus the inputs it has to buy technologically to produce that output times their prices to hire the inputs or buy them. So that's profit. You maximize that subject to the fact that, you know, you got to pay those prices and whatever in your technology function.
So then is it a matter of applying those principles widely across society that leads to what is called welfare economics, sort of taking those concepts?
Well, let's do equilibrium first.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, so equilibrium, now that, you know, we're almost there. So,
okay.
But this is great. I don't think I've ever had this particular conversation before, you know what I mean? So this is good stuff that you're asking me questions. I've never had to explain this before in this way. So what equilibrium then is in a standard model like that is that, yeah, all the consumers, given what their income is or their budget and given what they see as market prices that they just assume are out there as facts of the world, they then have the ability, they can buy as many units of the different types of goods available as they want. And what they're trying to do is to maximize their utility function. And the only constraint is they can't spend more than their income. All right. So it's like technically an inequality constraint. And then there's firms in the model that produce the stuff, and their goal is, you assume the firm maximizes profit subject to the fact that, you know, there's a given price for its output. There's given prices, you know, if it wants to hire workers, they have to pay them wage rates. If they want to borrow capital. You know, there's the interest rate and stuff like that. And then there's a what's called a production function, right? There's a technological recipe relating, saying if you combine this many labor hours with this many, you know, land and other resources, out shoots physically this amount of goods. You know, to actually produce a car, technology is involved somehow. Obviously, if you're a firm trying to say how many cars do we want to make. So, and that's what all the firms do. So then an equilibrium in that setting just means it's a set of prices such that given those prices, everybody's optimizing and is content with, you know, what they're assigned to do. And it's all internally consistent. So the firms are making the different combinations of goods that add up to exactly what the consumers want to buy, right? So if you know, Jim wants to buy 6 gallons of gas and Sally wants to buy 4, and they're the only two consumers, then the gasoline vendor wants to sell 10. That has to be his optimal thing. And so get those all to add up. So you can see how it turns into just a system of simultaneous equations. And that's what Walras did.
Okay.
He kind of showed how, you know, you had these simplistic worlds and a bunch of equations that all have to be true in equilibrium, and then showed conditions under which an equilibrium would exist. Okay. So that's just equilibrium.
And are in the assumptions that lead to equilibrium, is that when we talk about the assumption of a rational consumer that and knowledge about the prices and the fact that all the goods are essentially the same and are commodified or fungible, or is that not really necessarily directed to?
Okay, right. Good question.
Related to the equilibrium concept.
Right. So if people stop and think about what I just said, so I, you know, went through that real fast and it sounds straightforward, and it is. But then if you stop and think about it, there are a lot of assumptions. And by the way, this is the danger of mathematical economics, is you can get a result and it looks so rigorous, but then when you say, okay, but is that really a model of what's going on in the real world? Clearly, you know, the real world's not just a system of simultaneous equations of production functions. You know what I mean? Clearly this is just a model. And then the question is, you know, the problem would be you get so tied up in the model and its internal beauty and elegance that you believe it and you don't realize it. No, it's just a model. So yeah, one of the things there that we were assuming is that the consumers know what's good for them, right? And so if the consumer wants to buy a pack of cigarettes a day, because look at maximize utility. And that's, so as economists who aren't making, you know, paternalistic value judgments on other people, we could just say, no, you know, Jim, the reason he spent his money was he was optimizing. And so we as economists can explain that objectively, just as positive economics, by saying Jim gets more utility from cigarettes than he does from broccoli.
Right.
And that's why Jim acts the way he does. And this health nut over here who, you know, bikes 20 miles a day and, you know, eats soy and stuff, that person gets more utility from riding his bike than from smoking cigarettes. And we can explain everything. So you can see how some people might object to that and say, well, you know, you're endorsing it, or you're being coy. So that's one line of argument. I think what you're getting at is models that were, in a minute we'll get to the welfare stuff, but there's some standard results to say that that competitive equilibrium is optimal under certain conditions. And so people came along to challenge that, to say, okay, but in the real world, it's not true, for example, that, like, one of the conditions there that we had in those optimization problems that I defined a minute ago is that the prices are just given, right? So what you're technically doing is you're searching for a vector of prices for every possible good or service, such that given this vector, if everyone assumes these are the prices, end of story, the firms all optimize and maximize profit, the consumers all optimize their utility or maximize utility subject to their budget constraint, and boom, that's the equilibrium. Well, in the real world, a firm that has market power, for example, knows, it's, you know, Nike, it's not just that it looks out in the newspaper and says, hey, what's the price of our sneakers today? How many should we make?
Right.
They know that our decisions affect what the price will be. Okay, so whereas like with the wheat farmer, there you really do just look at the world price. You know what I mean? Like, any individual wheat farmer really can't, even if he totally shuts down, it's not like the world price of wheat's going to go up very much. And so the wheat farmer is like the paradigmatic example of someone who really is a, quote, price taker, whereas other industries are more characterized by some big players who have what's called market power. Okay. So that's just one example of how that little cute model I described obviously does not describe the real world, because, for example, not everyone, you know, views the prices as just given to them.
Okay.
Hey, folks, let's take a break from my discussion of healthcare economics. to talk about the Laura Murphy Report. This is the financial publication that I co-publish with Carlos Lara, and we talk about the financial sector from the perspective of both Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept, or IBC. And I want to just tell you, we have a special summer promotional deal. If you subscribe on or before July 4th, you get your first six issues for a grand total of $30. That's a pretty low investment threshold. Check out the details and sample issues of the LMR at bobmurphyshow.com/LMR.
So that's equilibrium.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get to what you mentioned at the beginning of our talk, to optimal versus
right.
equilibrium.
Sure.
And that's a normative statement where you decide what's good for the whole of society or...
Right. Yep. So here's now where we get into welfare economics.
Okay.
And so there's, I think they're called the first and second fundamental theorems of welfare economics. So the, before I say what the theorems are though, let me just define something. So something is called Pareto optimal, or sometimes people say Pareto efficient. So we got those terms optimal and efficient, but the adjective Pareto is saying this is the sense in which we're using those terms. And it's named after Vilfred Pareto, the Italian economist. So it's a very weak condition. And so this is what it says, that it's easier to say, what would it mean if it's not Pareto efficient? So if a certain allocation of resources, right? So we've got resources in the economy. They can be used in various combinations to produce certain combinations of output, like goods and services, and then they can be allocated to the individuals in the society, and you know they have their utility functions that are all in principle different from each other, because you know utility is subjective, value is subjective in your mind. So right. You can have that. Now we can stop and look at the outcome, like you know we've produced these combinations of goods and services and given them to people under a certain rule or whatever. And then we can ask of that outcome and say, is it possible technologically, you know, given what our resources are and our knowledge of how to make stuff, could we theoretically come up with a different way of using resources to produce goods and services and then to distribute them to everybody such that every single person in society would agree that alternative outcome is preferable according to my own subjective viewpoint to what the status quo is. And if that's the case, then Pareto wants to say that first outcome clearly is inefficient or suboptimal. If there's a way we can make everybody better off, even according to his or her own subjective standards, clearly we should not tolerate that first outcome. So it's very weak. And so you see the clever way they're trying to get around making value judgments. They're trying to be neutral analysts, but also, you know, to render an opinion about whether a situation's good or bad. And they're saying, if the outcome is such that every single person in society agrees, I would prefer B to A, then clearly A can't be a good outcome.
Okay.
Okay. So a Pareto inefficient outcome is one that, you know, everybody, there exists something that's preferable according to everybody's viewpoint. So a Pareto efficient outcome means that's not the case. And so the implication logically is if you moved away from a Pareto efficient outcome, at least one person in society would be hurt by it, would say, no, actually, if we change, I personally don't like where you're moving us to.
Right.
So and this is where people get confused. In general, there could be an infinite number of Pareto optimal states. Okay. So, and also, we don't need to dwell on this, but I used to use this as a little brain teaser when I would teach this stuff, just to make sure people at home who are like sitting there thinking it through, you could move from a Pareto inefficient state to a Pareto efficient state and hurt someone. That's logically possible. Okay. And just to think through, because
you define the Pareto efficient state once you're there, right? I mean, once you're there, then if you
right.
move,
if you move away from it, right, necessarily someone gets hurt.
Right. Right. But to get there, you can hurt people.
Right. So what is true is if you start at a Pareto inefficient state, there exists a Pareto optimal state that you can move to that helps everybody.
Right.
There has to exist. So that's what made the first thing suboptimal. Right. But my point is just you could move from a suboptimal one to an optimal one. And depending on the optimal one you picked, because in general, there's an infinite number.
Right.
Somebody could be hurt.
You could justify a utilitarian calculus where some people get hurt and, you know, if,
right.
You know, Okay.
Right. So yeah, I just want to be clear that it's because a lot of times when people hear those definitions, they think it means anytime you move from a Pareto suboptimal to optimal state, everyone's helped. And I'm saying, better. No, right. That's not correct.
Right. Okay. Okay. Well, that's a good point. So those are, there's a second theorem of
So I didn't give you the theorems yet. Yeah. So that's, just, I'm just defining what do we mean by Pareto optimal?
Oh, okay.
Okay. So now the first fundamental welfare theorem says that under certain conditions, and this is what Arrow gets at, you know, he summarizes this stuff in the first few pages of the paper, under certain conditions that he says, like, if every good is marketable, right? So if there's full markets, if markets are well-behaved, if, you know, people are price takers, that's the way we can summarize it. So under these types of conditions, every competitive equilibrium is Pareto optimal. Okay. So that's kind of like endorsing the invisible hand. It's like a mathematical codification of
right, because
that idea.
Presumably, through market mechanisms, people are, you know, automatically optimizing their own utility and so forth. And so if there are many suppliers and many consumers and whatnot, you'll reach that kind of optimal equilibrium. Is that the general idea?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. It's been a while since I've looked at the actual proof. Like, so the way you prove it mathematically actually does dovetail with the intuition. But yeah, I think it's fine for our purposes just to say clearly, you know, so what would it mean if it weren't, right? So suppose you had a competitive equilibrium and there was a way to move to a different outcome where every single person would be better off. Well, then clearly at least one consumer must not be optimizing given the prices and the output. You see what I'm saying? Like,
right.
The idea is if it were possible to deviate from the equilibrium to make everybody better off, then how could it be an equilibrium? Like, why wouldn't some firm, you know, change what it's doing or some consumer?
Correct.
So that's kind of the intuition that it's a proof by contradiction. You show it, that's impossible. If you're in a competitive equilibrium, to make one person better off, you necessarily have to hurt somebody else. That's kind of the way you would prove it.
Okay.
So therefore, it's got to be Pareto optimal. Right. Then the second fundamental welfare theorem just says you can pick any Pareto optimum you want. So remember, the Pareto optimum, the definition of that, it doesn't have anything to do with the social structure. Like, you can imagine it as being socialist or, you know, capitalist, whatever. It's just looking at how are resources used to produce output and then how is that output distributed to people. You don't care about the mechanism socially by which that happens.
Okay.
And so what the second fundamental welfare theorem says is that, you know, looking at the underlying data, the resource supplies, technology, the utility functions, look at the whole set of Pareto optimal outcomes. Because again, in general, you know, there's a whole bunch of them, perhaps an infinite number. You can pick anyone you want and I can show you how to come up with a competitive market equilibrium that results in that particular Pareto optimal outcome, so long as you let me redistribute income on the front end. Okay, so in general, a competitive market equilibrium goes to a Pareto optimal outcome, but remember, there's a bunch of them. And so if you're saying, oh no, but what if we wanted to go to a different one? Could the market support that? You'd say, oh yes, market forces would lead you there, but we may have to rearrange, you know, the initial property holdings or wealth so that, you know, so if you wanted to go to a Pareto optimal outcome where Bill Gates only gets 10 cans of tuna fish a year, he obviously can't start out as a billionaire. You've got to take his property away and give it to somebody else.
Okay.
But then if you did that and everyone now knows what the property titles are, you say, okay, market, go. It would end up in that Pareto optimal outcome where Bill Gates just gets 10 cans of tuna fish.
Got it. But clarify something for me, because you said that the first theorem, it holds irrespective of the political system, meaning it's holds under socialism or free market.
Oh, no, sorry. What I was saying is that the concept of Pareto efficiency is just talking about the distribution of goods. We don't worry about how do people get their hands on them. And so then the first theorem says a competitive market
economy gets you. Got it. Okay. All right. Very interesting, because now we're getting to essentially where this paper starts by Arrow.
Yeah. So maybe I'll do, before we jump into Arrow, so let me give one example. So this is the way that, like, a standard economist could be against tariffs and for free trade, right? So somebody like Adam Smith would make intuitive arguments and try to show that, oh, well, you know, people in both countries could be wealthier. And, you know, David Ricardo solidified it with his notion of comparative advantage. But the way a more modern economist could make the case to show you why is imposing a tariff bad. So let's say we initially start with free trade and then the government puts a tariff on TVs from China, let's say. And so what happens? Well, some people are helped and some are harmed, right? So the people that are harmed are U.S. consumers who now have to pay a higher price for television sets. So they're clearly hurt. But U.S. firms that hired U.S. workers to make TVs, if there even are anymore, I don't know.
Right.
But if they were, they would clearly be helped, right, by this tariff that's, you know, keeping out foreign imports. And so in general, you might think, well, how could economists possibly render an opinion on that? That, you know, are they saying some people are more important than us? And so the way you would explain it using this Pareto optimal framework is you would say, well, no, the situation with the tariff in place is Pareto inefficient or Pareto suboptimal, because there's a way, if we let in the imports, you know, we got rid of the tariff, the total gains to the consumer are bigger than the losses to the producers. And so if we compensated them, right, if there's somehow, you know, if we captured, if the consumers like made side payments to the producers, you know, the former U.S. TV makers who now lose their job because of cheap Chinese TV imports, the consumers save so much on lower TV prices that they could make side payments to the workers, that the workers say, oh yeah, I would much rather get the side payment and have a job pumping gas rather than working in the TV factory. I'm better off. The consumers would say, yep, I'm saving so much on cheaper TV prices that the portion I have to pay into this fund to compensate them.
Right.
And so you can see how there's, you could come up with a strategy that every single American would prefer the free trade alternative to the, you know, the other one. And so that's, and then last thing I'll just say is, of course, in practice, what if there's not compensation, right? So that's where where it gets tricky is, so that's the sense in which the protectionist, the tariff situation is not efficient. But so then if you just say, okay, let's get rid of the tariff and we don't do the side payments and the TV workers just get laid off and, you know, now they're pumping gas and they have a lower paying job and they're, and the consumers of TVs just get to pocket the gain fully and they don't have to, you know, make a compensation fund. That's still a Pareto optimal outcome now under free trade. But notice we went from an inefficient to a Pareto optimal and we hurt some people.
And people got hurt, right.
Yeah, so that's kind of like an example of the thing I said before as a possibility.
But when we talk about people getting hurt during these changes of equilibrium, you know, from one state to the next, is there any account of time? Of, I mean, you're going to be hurt because they could be hurt, you know, for a month or two, but then they, you know, I mean, things could get rearranged and overall. So how does that factor in or does it get factored in at all?
Okay, so that's a great, yeah, that's a great question. So yeah, in these real off-the-cuff, first slice at it approaches, there's not time. It's just a static, here's the situation with the tariff, here's what the prices are, here's what the, you know, production of TVs are, blah, blah, blah. Look at the utilities of everybody, and then get rid of the tariff, look at the new equilibrium. So you're just comparing two static states, there's no time involved. And then you're saying, ah, look at, you know, everybody in principle could be made better off in state number two than compared to state number one. So state number one's inefficient. You're right. And that's part of the argument for free trade in a real world that I would say is, you know, you could say, you talk about innovation. So yeah, any particular protected industry with the moment you get rid of a tariff on just them, yep, you guys are hurt. But look, in the long run, especially if it's a consistent policy, you benefit as consumers if we get rid of the other tariffs too. And in general, you know, the government just trying to lock in production techniques and dominant market share, that's going to stifle progress.
Right.
Right. Like if back in the day when the car was being, this is a standard example, the car was being developed, that threatened the horse and buggy industry.
Sure.
But clearly it would have been crazy if the government just, you know, locked down and prevented cars from entering the scene because, oh, we got to save jobs for the horse and buggy manufacturers. And so, you know, that's clearly, you know, showing over time, everybody tends to benefit from progress. But you're right. That's more of like a political economy type verbal argument in terms of these models. They typically don't have time in the model itself.
Right. So, I mean, the way you've described them, I mean, they're kind of neat and whatnot, but you said it, and I think it's perhaps, I don't know if it was recognized at the time that Arrow wrote the paper, but these models are pretty, I mean, they're unrealistic, I mean, fundamentally unrealistic on several important levels. Did that, is that apparent now, or is it more apparent now that they're unrealistic, and has there been a backlash, or they, you know, economists just go with it and say, okay, they're unrealistic, but nevertheless, they're informative and they can tell us things about what to do. They can inform policy, that sort of thing.
Okay, so now that the listeners here have these basic building blocks, it's really easy to go into what's called market failure and why I think that this intellectual hobby horse or whatever, this foundation we've talked about, has been now grossly misapplied in practice to lead to bad policy. So it's almost as if the market's so beautiful that it's the state of its perfection, you know, then is the benchmark against which we judge real markets. And so economists took those. So here's how it kind of developed. They come up with these fundamental welfare theorems that codified the assumptions or the conditions under which a decentralized competitive market equilibrium would be Pareto optimal. Okay. Mm-hmm. And now we're finally at the point where people can understand those terms. And then economists said, well, wait, but look, in the real world, markets do not satisfy all these conditions, right? It's not the case that every firm is a price taker. There's market power. It's not the case that consumers really know what's good for them. So like the way you could model that is consumers think their utility function's one thing, but really their utility function's something else.
Right.
You know, like a heroin addict goes and spends everything he has on getting the next fix. And there's a sense in which you want to say that's really not good for him in the long run. Okay.
Right.
So, you know, that's the other way. So how do you model that? Well, there's different approaches, but the point is clearly to just say consumers have their preferences and they maximize utility. There's something missing there.
Sure.
Okay. So economists then in practice came up with all these exceptions to the assumptions necessary or the conditions necessary for that first fundamental welfare theorem, and then concluded, so clearly in the real world, the actual market outcome is not Pareto optimal. And then they breezily jumped to, and therefore government intervention in the market is justified to fix these market failures. So that's what a market failure means. It means if the market ends up in a Pareto suboptimal state, how could that be? Well, because clearly some of those conditions aren't satisfied, because we know theoretically if those conditions were satisfied, it has to be optimal. Right. So that's what market failure means. A good example is something like pollution, right? That if, in the model, if a firm's making more television sets and dumping chemicals in the river that's harming people downstream, those people don't have the ability to like pay for clean water, right? So if clean water were just a good that the firm could produce, in addition to TVs, and then it was just a different thing than the consumers in the market. You might think it was unfair, but it could not be a possible outcome where the consumers are getting too much pollution because they could just pay the firm for clean water. The firm, instead of just producing TVs, would also be producing clean water in the river. And, you know, so mathematically, everything would be great. So the way you would explain an outcome of where there's too much pollution is you'd say there's missing markets. It's not the case that every good and service is available with a price. So in that kind of case, then you say, this outcome is not Pareto efficient, and therefore the government can come in and, you know, put regulations on the firm you can't dump in the river, or charge them a tax, you know, for every amount of sludge you dump in, you know, you have to pay $10 to the government, blah, blah, blah. And that's the way we're correcting the market failure. So that was the whole justification for government intervention using standard welfare economics. Is they're saying there's all these market failures, the government in principle could fix them. And so I, as an economist, would now say, okay, theoretically, if you've quote explained market failure or put your finger on it, you then need to show that the government in practice actually will address those, right? It's not enough just to say the market's not perfect to then say the government intervention is justified. You have to show me a convincing reason to believe that what the government's doing actually will ameliorate those imperfections. And in practice, of course, what both theoretically and in terms of history, I think it's pretty obvious the government doesn't improve on the market outcome.
I think Arrow makes a tiny allusion to that possibility in his paper, and perhaps we'll get to it. But this is, I think, a great, sort of backdrop for grabbing the paper and being a little bit oriented to what he's talking about, which we can do in the next segment, because I think from what you've said, it seems that Arrow then is applying these principles and these models that you've described to healthcare and trying to see where does healthcare fails in terms of satisfying the criteria of that would lead, normally lead to optimality. And then perhaps conclude then, therefore, there are these market failures, and therefore, he explains where the market failures might be coming from. And then the conclusion would be that we would need government intervention. Although he's very tentative in his assertions. He's trying not to take any firm position.
Yeah,
right, so, as he goes through. Yeah. He's just, you know, sketching different possibilities in his analysis of the medical market.
Right. So yeah, strictly speaking, what he is doing in this paper, and you know, we will in the next segment we'll explain the backdrop and whatever and why it's such a big deal. But yeah, fundamentally you hit the nail on the head. He's trying to say, okay, given that we as economists have this framework for welfare economics, what does it mean for an outcome to be efficient? What are the assumptions necessary for a decentralized market outcome to lead us to a reasonably efficient outcome? Clearly, in the real world, let's look at the healthcare sector. It fails on numerous ways. And so we have no reason to trust that the free market will deliver efficiency when it comes to healthcare. Whereas, you know, when it comes to bottles of milk or something, yeah, the market's pretty good. You don't need the government micromanaging that. But yeah, there's no reason to expect the market outcome to be efficient in the sense that you and I have talked about when it comes to healthcare. And then, like you say, he is, I mean, Arrow's a sharp guy. He's very concerned, attentive to detail, and very rigorous. So yes, he knows just because I pointed out that the market can't deliver healthcare well doesn't necessarily tell us, well, then what should the government do about it? But you know, clearly that's what everybody in this tradition has taken away from his article. It's like, market can't do healthcare, so we're not just going to throw up our hands. What does that mean? Well, clearly the government's got to do something.
Right, right. And he's also a lot of his, he couches everything as, or many of his points as hypotheses to be tested by econometrician to determine whether indeed the medical market behaves in a non-competitive way or not. I mean, he says, you know, it's possible that it would and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, perhaps maybe it's a good place to stop here and pick it up, you know, pick up the paper and then go through it and see exactly what he's doing.
Did you want to real quickly just mention Rothbard on this whole stuff?
You know, right. As a critique of this model, I mean, this welfare economics model, you're right. Thanks for mentioning that.
Sure.
Because it seems that, I mean, from my understanding is that since Arrow, since, you know, the heyday of welfare economics, perhaps in the 50s and 60s, people have realized that the model is kind of unrealistic and maybe have made adjustments to it and or say, well, it's unrealistic, but we know that and therefore we're going to be more measured in our prescriptions. But nobody has, at least in mainstream economics, nobody has said, you know, this whole approach is really, I mean, there's a better way of looking at welfare economics.
Right. So yeah, Rothbard has a famous essay called A Reconstruction of Utility in Welfare Economics, I think is the title. And it's, for those who just know Rothbard's more popular stuff, like aimed at the layperson, this is a quite technical paper and shows that Rothbard back in the day, you know, he was really up to speed on the latest advances in, you know, formal mathematical economics.
That was published in 56 or 58 or something like that. I think before the Arrows paper, if I recall.
I think you're right. Yeah, I don't know off the top of my head, but I think you're right.
Okay.
And so just for our purposes, I'll summarize some of the takeaways. So one thing is, you know, this idea of positive or negative externalities, which is one of the main components of, you know, people alleging market failure, so-called market failure, is you could argue these are pretty vacuous, right? So in general, yeah, obviously someone's dumping pollution in the river. And one response to that is like, okay, well, the problem there, it's not a lack of government. It's that there's not adequate property rights, right? That it's because the government, and there's historical case law where you can see that what happened was originally under the common law tradition. So if you're downstream from a factory polluting the river, you could get an injunction against them. Say, hey, you're violating my property rights. And the courts, you know, judges didn't want to do that, rule in that favor of that because they thought that would impede industrial progress.
Right, right. So in fact, government intervention was promoting.
Right. So these
kind of behavior
examples are not situations of big bad business trampling the common man. It's the government intervening in league with big business in order to trample traditional property rights. So that's one element in terms of just the history of it. But beyond that, just in terms of the concept. Walter Block says this too, and I might be conflating what Rothbard said in Block, but you know, you could come up with all kinds of stuff. Like in principle, you know, just you and me doing this podcast, Michelle. I mean, technically, we're showering benefits on people, and so this is market failure. And you and I would talk for longer if people could pay us on the side, and so therefore, the government ought to tax everybody and subsidize you and me to keep talking,
right?
And I could certainly come up with an argument and point to some people who are helped. And then someone who hates our guts could say, no, you're actually harming society. You're causing, you know, you're confusing people and taking away the impetus for socialized medicine. And therefore, you're harming people. So you should be taxed, you know, to, right. to get you to do this less. So right. the point, you know, you could make an argument showing how, you know, yes, the concepts are logically coherent, but in practice, it's pretty vacuous. I think Walter Block has an example of, you know, if I wear smelly socks around, well, that causes harms to people. And so, you know, it's just everything you do is, in other words, everything has a whole spectrum of infinite positive and negative externalities. And so if we're going to use that as a benchmark to critique the market, you know, that's pretty open-ended. And then beyond that, Rothbard, I think, makes a pretty elegant point that, okay, if you're going to use this notion of Pareto efficiency as your benchmark or your criterion, you can never in practice justify any government intervention because there's always at least one philosophical anarchist who, if the government does anything, is going to say, hey, I oppose that. I prefer right. the status quo to that government intervention. So stop fooling yourself. No, in practice, it's impossible for government intervention to yield a Pareto improvement because there's always going to be at least one cranky old guy objecting and saying, no, I don't like this. And he's not lying. Like, he really is, you know, opposed to government right. action per se. And so Robert's like, see, so stop hiding behind this veneer of we're being objective scientists. We're not imposing our value. Clearly you are. You're pro-government intervention and you're using this apparatus to justify what you wanted
right.
to happen anyway.
Right. And then also there's they seem that there's an invariable reversal against the subjective value theory in a way, because, you know, they'd be quick to say, I mean, I don't know how apparent it is, but I mean, you were giving the example of the guy who smokes cigarettes and that's his mm-hmm. utility and mm-hmm. whatnot. And, you know, they might come and say, listen, I mean, these people are obviously doing, you know, they're behaving irrationally, right? I mean, the irrational behavior argument mm-hmm. that they might use that as one of the conditions that is not being met and therefore that justifies government intervention because obviously the consumers are not right. behaving rationally. And
yes. So this is a good point. So you're right that it certainly smacks of them just being paternalist and second guessing someone else's preferences. And hey, if ever, you know, value is subjective, who are we to judge? And I thought you economists
right.
were trying to be value neutral. So in terms of, they're called the modern, what are they called? It's like the new paternalism or something like that. And I think they even use the term, like it's not their critics labeling it like that. And so the way they get around that is they'll say, look, if somebody really does want to smoke and get lung cancer and is perfectly happy with that, even over, you know, the decades and on his deathbed as he's dying from lung cancer, says, I regret nothing. Okay, fine. We have nothing to say about that. But in practice, clearly, there's a sense in which if you actually asked people who were chain smokers for 30, they would say, oh, yeah, I was addicted. I tried to quit 17 times and I just, you know, I couldn't stop. Or just forget smoking, just in general, like procrastination. You know, that term, what does it mean? Procrastination is not the same thing as optimal delay. You know, you know what I mean? Saying, oh, scheduling things in terms of priority or triage. When you say procrastination, what you mean is, I really wish I had the willpower to do this thing 6 weeks ago and I keep not doing it and I'm kicking myself. What the hell's wrong with me? Right. That's what you mean when you talk about I'm procrastinating. You mean I wish I didn't do that. Or I really think I should be going to the gym more. Man, I keep eating apple pie instead. So there's a sense in which you're not doing what you really want to in the long run because of willpower issues. So that's the kind of thing where these new paternalists can justify like a tax on cigarettes or
their nudges.
Exactly. That's the whole nudge thing is right. subsidies to gym membership, where because like you actually endorse this quote coercion being applied. It's the same principle. Last thing I'll say here, I know we want to stop and get in the Arrow's paper, but what's funny is there, even to the extent that stuff's true, and yeah, I think it'd be obtuse to deny that they're pointing to something real about humans and how they behave. But okay, that's why you can do it voluntarily, right? So if it really is the case that people would endorse these schemes, well, then you can implement them in a voluntary fashion. So for example, there's certain gym memberships where at the start, when you join the gym, you give them a lot of money, like more than what they need to pay their trainers and to pay for the equipment. And then if you hit your weight loss goals, they give you some of your money back. Mm. So that's a way you can voluntarily agree to this procedure where then you're getting subsidized to go to the gym and it's totally voluntary, right? So you can call that nudging. And so that's the kind of thing I mean where there's a lot of ways, even to the extent that you agree this stuff is true. And hey, people aren't these simple automatons that you economists assume in your models. Fair enough. But that still doesn't justify government intervention.
Right. Sure. Did Rothbard, in his paper, I haven't read it, did he positively demonstrate that, you know, a complete laissez-faire is going to be, by some definition, optimal? I mean, you mentioned that the government used the case of the anarchist, but that seems kind of extreme. Apart from using the argument of the one anarchist in society who would be heard by government intervention, did he show in general that government intervention will typically be less optimal than it would be than what the market would eventually provide? Or is that something that he wants to stay away from altogether, these concepts of trying to reach optimal states or that sort of thing?
Yeah, so what he does do, and I don't know if this is answering your question, is Rothbard, I forget the terminology he used, but he did say that, look, in a practical sense, we can say that the market outcome is optimal in the following sense, that any particular transaction that occurs in the marketplace is voluntary. If it's not voluntary, then it's not part of the market.
Right.
So if it's voluntary transactions, that's what the web of those is, what we mean by the market economy is, you know, mutually, well, voluntary transactions. So then you say, okay, what does it mean if it's voluntary? That means every participant expects to gain from it. That's why it's voluntary. That's why the people agree to do it.
And even so, if you're eating apple pie instead of going to the gym.
Right, exactly. The reason you're doing it, you know, if someone didn't hold a gun to your head, you're doing it. So you expected to get more utility from eating the apple pie than from refraining from doing so. And the person who sold you the pie likes your money more than that unit of apple pie. So you both gain from that trade. And so the market economy then is the collection of all these actions or transactions that make each participant better off than before. And where, you know, when things settle down, when there's no more activity in the market and you come to a state of rest, that's because there does not exist any other mutually advantageous exchange, at least that people know about.
Right.
And so he's saying, in the real world, what better benchmark could there be of making everybody as well off as possible without hurting somebody than to say, let everybody make as many voluntary transactions as they can think of and discover, and you're not allowed to do anything that somebody would object to. And, you know, so that's what he, you know, I forget what term he uses.
Got it. I think he used, is that the paper in where he used the term demonstrated preferences instead of revealed preferences?
Right. Yeah.
So he's saying,
So he's saying that in practice, a lot of these neoclassical models are assuming they can get in the minds of people and know what their preferences are, and saying, as social scientists, no, we actually don't. All we can observe is behavior. And so he's saying the most we can really say is, when this guy spends $100 on a TV set from this guy, the guy who spent the $100 thinks the TV's, you know, gives more utility than the $100, and vice versa for the seller.
Right.
And we can say they both demonstrated that they gained utility from doing that because it was voluntary. That's really all
even,
we can say.
Even if the guy regretted it later on. I mean, that's...
Right, yeah. That's you know, we're not saying people are omniscient, but again, if something's voluntary, that means at the moment of choice, they must have thought it would benefit them. That's why they agreed to do it.
Bob, that's great. Let's take a break.
Okay.
And then we'll talk about Eros paper.
Okay, sure thing.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.